always like to do a few minutes of silent meditation with the group before giving the talk. So we'll do another few minutes here of breathing meditation to let the mind settle, and then we'll go into the verse from Don't Believe Everything You Think. Okay? So sit up straight, lower your eyes. And see your breath as home. Yeah, you're always breathing, so you can always come home to your breath. And as you do the breathing meditation at different times, you'll notice that your breath is sometimes different. It's slow and smooth. Sometimes it's quicker and rather coarse, has an edge to it. And you'll find that the different ways your breath feels correlate to your different mental states. So often, just by observing your breath, it gives you a clue as to what is going on in your mind. And similarly, if you, for example, are agitated, if you take a few minutes to sit down and breathe, and you just slow your breath a tinge, not forcing it or anything, just slow it a little bit, you'll find that your mind will settle down and the agitation will vanish. So it's quite interesting to watch these correlations between the mind and the breath and how they influence each other. So it'll take a few minutes to observe the breath and let the mind settle down. And before having the teaching, let's generate our motivation and think that we'll listen and share together so that we can learn about our own mind, learn how to make our mind more peaceful, and by having a more peaceful and open mind, may we make a positive contribution to society, to the world, to all living beings. So let's have that very broad motivation, wanting to be of benefit and service to all living beings, even though we're just doing one seemingly small act for an hour now. Okay. So we've been over the last several, must be a couple of years by now, going through this book, Don't Believe Everything You Think, which is a commentary on a Tibetan poem called The 37 Practices of Bodhisattvas. Bodhisattvas are beings who have, who cherish others more than themselves and want to become fully awakened so that they can be of the most effective benefit to other living beings. So this poem kind of tells how they practice. And we're almost at the very end of the poem. But fortunately, the end deals with very general topics. It's interesting, it gets kind of harder and harder. And then the last seven verses are more about how to apply in your, well, everything is about how to apply in your daily life, but, you know, more general kinds of topics. So this book also contains stories that different people told me that happened to themselves, you know, so they're all true stories about how they applied these verses and how the verses applied to their lives. So we'll discuss that a little bit too. Okay. We're on verse 35 today, which is about banishing bad habits. So I know none of you have bad habits, but that the people you live with have bad habits, right? So you can listen to this and then go home and tell them about it. Yeah. Okay, so it says, habitual disturbing emotions are hard to stop through counteractions. Armed with antidotes, the guides of mindfulness and introspective awareness, destroy disturbing emotions like attachment at once as soon as they arise. This is the practice of bodhisattvas. Okay, so habitual disturbing emotions. Let's take a minute. Now, what are those? Well, disturbing emotions such as clinging attachment, anger, jealousy, arrogance, laziness, not being negligent about our ethics, forgetfulness of, you know, what to practice, what to abandon, all sorts of things, you know, just not caring, yeah, blocking things out, being apathetic. So we have a lot of these disturbing emotions. All of us, the Buddha said, have 84,000. So don't think you're better or worse than anybody else. It's not that you have 84,001 or 83,999. You're in the company, we all are in the same boat, okay? So that creates a very strong commonality by which we can certainly understand each other. So we have certain habitual disturbing emotions, ones that come up very strongly. You know, we may have a certain disturbing emotion that is really strong in us, and we may have certain particular situations in which a disturbing emotion habitually comes up, kind of like push button. You know, our buttons get pushed, and we always react the same way emotionally without even considering that there may be a choice or an option for another kind of motivation, another kind of emotion. Okay, so let's just take, they often talk of the three principal ones. So ignorance or confusion, not knowing, you know, what's right to do, what's wrong to do, just a lot of confusion in the mind. Then attachment, clinging to things, not wanting to be separated from them. They're mine, you can't have them, this kind of thought. And then anger, which is, you know, wanting to trash something or get away from it, you know, fight or flight, because all we see is negative qualities, whereas with attachment, all we see is positive qualities and we cling, okay? So just looking at your mind, just as a general, broad, first thing, how many of you would say that you have more problems with attachment, that it's your big one to work on? Okay. How many have anger? Would you say it's a bigger problem for you? Okay. How about general confusion? How about all three? Yeah. We have all three, don't we? Yeah. But we may have one or another that is more prominent. And so it's helpful in our spiritual practice to focus on that one and really work on that one, because if it's stronger and it's more habitual, it's going to be, you know, it's going to interfere more with our lives. Okay, so we usually pick that one. Okay, but it's interesting to look at what kinds of situations, let's say, attachment arises in or anger arises in. You know, attachment certainly to food. Yes? No? Food? Yeah? Okay, people? You attached to people? Yeah? To getting ahead in your job? Oh, you all look so sweet and innocent. Yeah? Money and possessions? Nobody's attached to that. Oh, I see. So you're going to give all your money to charity today, huh? No attachment to it. Huh? Are you attached to being right? Yeah? Or attached to, you know, winning the argument, even if you're wrong? Okay. Yeah? We can be attached to our physical appearance, to our health, to youth, to many, many different kinds of things. Yeah. And similarly, when something interferes with our happiness, we get upset. Yeah. Upset sounds nicer than angry, doesn't it? Yeah. We don't like to say we're angry. We don't like to say we hate people. We just like to say, we're upset. That sounds much more polite, doesn't it? Yeah. But we get upset, or angry, or enraged, or outraged, or vicious. Yeah. When we're criticized, wouldn't you say? Yeah, criticism. When things don't go the way we want, when somebody takes our stuff, when somebody outranks us, we're competing with them and they do better than we do. Yeah. We get angry, don't we? We get angry when the food's not good, when the bed's too hard. So, you know, there's a lot of different situations in which anger comes. And mostly, we get angry at people, don't we? We may get angry at situations, but situations are, we don't like situations usually because of what's happening with the people. Would you say that? Would you say that most of your anger is with people? Yeah? I mean, you don't get mad at, you may be attached to money, but you don't get mad at the money. You get mad at the people who take it away from you. Okay? Or we may be attached to my idea, but, you know, when our idea doesn't get carried out, we aren't angry at the idea, we're angry at the people who didn't realize that our idea was the best one. How rude they are. How stupid. They didn't see my idea was the best one. Okay? So, there are these kind of disturbing emotions are things that make us unhappy. They make us do things that impinge on the well-being of others and create and put seeds in our mind for long-term misery. So these disturbing emotions don't really do us any good. Yeah. They may sometimes give us a big buzz, like when you have a lot of adrenaline flowing, but you know, at the end of the day, they don't really benefit us in any lasting way. And so the Buddha, you know, examined these, and he saw that all these disturbing emotions are based on wrong conceptions. Yeah, specifically the wrong conception of who we are, and then after that, a host of other wrong conceptions about how other people exist, how things exist. And we're so familiar with our wrong conceptions that we don't even see them as erroneous. And instead, we think that's just the way things are and that any sane person would see things the way we see things. Yeah, which is why when people don't see things our way, we tend to think they are insane. Yeah? We see that so much with what's happening politically now. Yeah? And then also in the tragedies this whole last week. Yeah? We adopt a certain viewpoint. We're attached to our viewpoint, and people who don't agree with it, they're, you know, something's really seriously wrong with them. And then, of course, we psychoanalyze them, even though we know nothing about psychology. And, you know, give them some kind of label and then just dismiss them. That's all. As if all they were their ideas and their emotions, and that's, you know, the only thing that they amount to in life is ideas, emotions, and actions, you know. Not realizing that there's a human being in there that wants happiness and doesn't want to suffer. So the Buddha talked about different counteractions or different antidotes to these disturbing emotions. And they all have to do with removing the wrong conceptions that underlie them. Okay? So, for example, when we're very attached to something, if we're greedy and we're clinging, we've exaggerated the good qualities of someone or something. And so the antidote is to see that object more clearly for what it is without all the good qualities we're exaggerating. Yeah? And sometimes we think, you know, we exaggerate that, oh, this situation, this person, whatever it is going to last forever, and it's going to make me eternally happy. And that is a big reason for our clinging. But then, you know, nothing is completely problem-free. Nothing is going to make us eternally happy. Nothing is fixed and static. So if we, you know, familiarize our mind more with the reality and get rid of these wrong conceptions, then the clinging attachment is going to decrease and our mind is going to be more peaceful, more balanced. Yeah? Similarly, when we're angry or upset, then we've exaggerated the negative qualities of someone or something, and we think it's always going to be like this, you know? I'm in a certain situation right now that I don't like. I'm always going to be in this situation. There's no opportunity to change it at all. And then we get angry. Yeah? or, you know, I'm in a bad mood. My bad mood is permanent, unchanging, you know, so just sign off. I'm just going to be miserable. Yeah. Or sometimes we even think certain personality qualities that we have are unchanging, you know. I have a bad temper, that's just the way I am. So, my dear family, you just have to live with it. Too bad. Yikes. You know, that's not going to create a lot of harmony in a family. Okay? So the Buddha, you know, talked about, pointed out many of these misconceptions and then gave us ways to see how they are not accurate, how they are misapprehending things. Okay? So that's what it says when it says habitual disturbing emotions are hard to stop through counteractions because they're so habitual. And because often we don't even know that we're in the midst of a habitual disturbing emotion until it's full-blown and crazy. Okay? So the next line says, armed with the antidotes, the guards of mindfulness and introspective awareness. Okay, so here's two things that are really going to help us notice our disturbing emotions and when they've gotten quite big, okay? Mindfulness, introspective awareness. So mindfulness is a mind that holds, it's an attitude that holds in our mind our ethical values, the principles that we want to live by. It holds in our mind, the kind of person that we want to be. Okay? So it remembers these things. The word mindfulness also can be translated as memory. Yeah, so it remembers the values, the principles, the true, deep, spiritual aims that we have in life. Introspective awareness goes together with mindfulness, okay? Because mindfulness has in mind, keeps in mind these things that are important to us. And then introspective awareness looks inside and says, am I focused on these things that are important? Am I keeping good ethical, you know, conduct? Am I listening to other people or am I judging them? Okay, so introspective awareness is aware of what's going on in our mind. It's aware of what we're saying and aware of what we're doing. Yeah, and so it's able to notice when we've gone off track. So, if we come back to our habitual disturbing emotions, you know how, especially with anger, often we don't notice we're angry until we're furious? Yeah? Does anybody have that happen? You know, it's only when you're completely ballistic that you finally say, oh, I guess I'm angry. But it isn't like we went from 0 to 100 on the anger scale in 1 second. Yeah, people may go more quickly, but it's always a process and it always starts small. So somehow at one point our anger was small, but we didn't notice it. Yeah, we weren't in tune. Our introspective awareness wasn't functioning. So we weren't in tune and didn't notice what was going on mentally, that we were in the process of exaggerating faults and getting angry. Yeah. So here is where introspective awareness can really help us, because our emotions often have a physical component in terms of how our body feels. Okay, so for example, when you're angry, what happens in your body?
It tenses.
It tenses, okay? So you have tension. What else do you have?
Blood pressure goes up.
Please speak louder.
Your blood pressure goes up.
Yeah, your blood pressure goes up, and so you can feel your heart pounding. Yeah? What else?
I hold my breath.
You hold your breath.
Yeah.
Yes, our breath becomes very short, doesn't it? Very quick and very short. What about your stomach? What happens in your stomach when you're angry?
Not soft jerks.
Yeah, it's like, you know, knots in your stomach, it churns. Okay. What about your palms? What happens to your palms?
Sweaty.
They get sweaty. Sometimes a cold sweaty. Yeah, it depends. So the thing is, if we can become aware of some of these physical things when they're still small, then we can get, and we can become aware of the anger when it's still small. So instead of waiting until, you know, if we tune into our body and are aware of our body, we can begin to see when there's a little bit of tension in it, or when our stomach is a little bit tight. Yeah? Or sometimes it might happen in your shoulders, you get tight. There may be different areas for different people where you get tight. Or maybe your fists are starting to clench, or your jaw is, okay? But if we can tune in to our body, we can see some of these physical things when they're still small, before the physical things get so overblown that, you know, our habitual disturbing emotion is also overblown. Okay? So it's a process of like, okay, what's going on with my body? What is my body feeling? And it's very interesting to observe what our body's feeling and see how that links to different emotions. Yeah? Because it can really give us a clue as to what our emotion is. The feeling in the body is not the emotion. The emotion is what's happening in our mind, in our consciousness. But the body is what's happening, that's like a correlate. So we can see, oh, my fists are like this. That's telling me I'm starting to get angry. And then, because the anger is still small, it's much easier to apply the antidote to anger. When we're completely in the midst of our anger, we can't even see or hear anything different than what our fury is. Can we? Yeah. We're gone. Yeah. So that's why when we get in quarrels with people, when we're that angry and they're that angry, nobody's listening to each other, because nobody's mind has any room to take in any other information aside from the thing that they are grasping onto is true, which actually isn't true. And both sides are doing this. Okay? So when we can catch the anger when it's small, then maybe we can step away from it and say, okay, why am I angry? Yeah. Well, somebody did blah, 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 blah. Yeah, but they're a person who wants happiness and they don't want to suffer. What use is it for me to be angry at them? Okay. Can I allow that there's a difference of opinion? Do I really have to hate everybody who thinks differently than me? No. You know, I can have room in my mind for differences. I can see that people are more than their ideas, and that given if I were put with this person in a different situation, I would have a totally different relationship with them. Okay? So we're able to apply the antidotes, yeah, when we can catch the disturbing emotions when they're small. And applying those antidotes, the mind settles. So what I would like to do is teach the whole country about this at this period. Yeah? Because you look at, you know, we had so much polarization politically. And then what happened last week between the murders of black men and the murders of police officers, then we have even more polarization. And all of it is totally useless, and it doesn't help any of us. And in fact, it only harms us. Because whether we like it or not, we are stuck living on this planet together, and we are living in this country together. So, you know, we better find a way to get along with each other. Yeah, for our own benefit and for the benefit of others. And one way to get along with each other is just to accept that different people have different ways of thinking. They have different priorities. Yeah, but that a person is more than their thoughts and their priorities. You know, they're a living being who at the basic core of it is just trying to be happy and not suffer. Okay? So, you know, without taking sides, we can see, you know, Black Lives Matter. People are, they want to be happy, they don't want to suffer. That's what's motivating them. Okay? The cops that overreact, and here I'm talking about a few cops, not all of them, but those who overreact, they're trying to be happy and not be miserable. Yeah? The cops who don't overreact, who have a good relationship with their public, trying to be happy, not be miserable. Yeah? The people who, an NRA, who want everybody in the society to be armed, are trying to be happy and not be miserable. You know, they are more than their ideas. And if we met these people in different situations, we would have a different relationship with them. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What do you do when the ideas that these people hold are detrimental to other people?
You speak up against the ideas. You talk about the ideas. You talk about the behavior. But you can do that without being angry at the people who do those actions or have that those thoughts. So this is what happens when we're able to apply the antidote to our anger. Emotionally, we calm down. We can see the situation more clearly. We can still talk about the ideas and the detrimental effects of certain ideas and certain behaviors, but we can do that within respecting the people who have those ideas and behaviors. Okay? And the fact that emotionally we're calmer enables us to communicate better. We can still be quite forceful in our communication, you know, but not physically forceful. I mean, we can make a very clear case, we certainly aren't, you know, just blah, well, whatever happens, it's all okay. You know, that's rubbish. But we don't have to hate those people. And there's one way of looking at it that I think is so helpful, because usually in a conflict, it's like, okay, here's the problem. I'm on this side, you're on this side, and we're fighting each other about the problem. Okay? Another model is, here's the problem. Both of us want to be free of pain. And this is very true for what's going on right now. Everybody wants to be free of pain. Everybody wants to be free of violence. Okay? So the pain and the violence are the problem. How about if both of us sit on the same side and look at the problem together? Okay, getting what I mean? Yeah, this kind of model works so much better. Yeah, because, you know, if we really look, our long-term goals, nobody wants to live in a violent, unpeaceful society. Of course, different people have different ways that they think it's going to work to create a peaceful society. Yeah. But let's come together, you know, based on the problem is right now, it's not peaceful. And we need to work together to find some way to make it more peaceful. You know, and not get locked into our ideas and think, I am my ideas and the other person is their ideas. Okay? It's a different way of seeing things, but I think it's one, and it involves training our mind. Okay? So if we can train our mind this way, then there's a much better chance that we will be able to communicate with each other. Which is basically what we want, don't we? Okay. So it says, you know, using mindfulness and mental alertness, then destroy disturbing emotions like attachment. I've been using anger, but we can apply the same thing to attachment. At once, as soon as they arise. So, in other words, not to indulge our disturbing emotions. Yeah, if we're being greedy and clinging to something, to acknowledge, my mental state is not very good right now. I have to let go of this. Not say, well, but attachment is making me feel good, and who knows, maybe I will win the lottery and blah, blah, you know, and then be miserable for a long time. Okay. Same with anger. Instead of getting all revved up and, you know, I'm going to go out and clobber those people, to be able to step back and say, you know, I want to destroy this negative emotion, this anger, you know, because it's destroying me, and I'm not going to wait until it gets so big that, you know, we do something that we later wish we hadn't done, or say something that we later wish we didn't say. Okay. So let me read you some stories. Some of the, I told you that some of the, our friends gave us stories about how this applied to them. Okay, so this is one story that he called Stop Fooling Myself, okay? Because his mindfulness and introspective alertness were out to lunch and he got himself in a big mess. So he says, because I was raised by a scientist and a nurse, I have trained myself to be better and smarter than everyone else. If you ask me, I'm really smart, and I'm charming, and I'm a good athlete, and people like me. Okay. This guy has a problem with arrogance, wouldn't you say so? Okay. Anyway, I'm sure I'm such a good guy, and I'm really good at my job too. Just ask around. Of course, this is the view of my arrogance, which I'm slowly coming to realize after years of being an alcoholic and lying about it to myself and others. It took doing some exceptionally stupid things, like getting emotionally involved with a prostitute and trying to help her separate from her boyfriend, Pimp, which she was not ready to do, and nearly ruining my professional career for me to just, so it took nearly doing both of those things, for me to just begin to stop believing everything I think. Now I'm trying to focus on the second verse of the 8 verses of thought transformation, which says, whenever I am with others, I will practice seeing myself as the lowest of all. And from the very depth of my heart, I will respectfully hold others as supreme. So for a person with a lot of arrogance like this, holding himself as the lowest of all, which does not mean having low self-esteem. It's not equivalent to low self-esteem. It's just releasing this arrogance. And respectfully holding others as supreme is going to be the antidote that's going to free him from being a big know-it-all. Okay? So he's realizing that he needs to practice this. I really need to start to get over myself. I don't even know why I need to be that cool guy that people like, but I better get that figured out too. During a recent meditation, I had a strong momentary insight into the fact that I don't even know my own mind. I can't trust my own thoughts, and I should not believe everything I think. That's a bit scary. One moment, one thought. The next moment, another thought that is the opposite. Do you find that in your mind? Dealing with the habitual disturbing emotions associated with all these thoughts is tumultuous. For example, I know I need to stop the relationship with the prostitute. It is unhealthy and it is not benefiting either of us. I have my resolve, and then 5 minutes later, I'm trying to rationalize a way to get in touch with her. Yeah? Do you have things like that in your life? Yeah, you make a determination and 5 minutes later, you're figuring out a way to do the opposite. Yeah. Then I think of the Dharma and I come to my senses. So he's been a lot, you know, practicing for a while. With each day of Dharma practice, the floodwaters of attachment abate a little more. But I need to be careful and to increase my mindfulness and introspective awareness and maintain them for a long time. The support of AA, my spiritual mentors, and my Dharma friends is essential to this process. So here's somebody who thought he knew it all and is saying now that he needs help and looking to support from wise friends. Okay? Here's another story. Okay? This one's called Guarding the Mind and the Mouth. Sometimes this idea of taping our mouth is a good one. Yeah. Our parents used to threaten to do it to us, but sometimes we come to our senses and realize we need to do it ourselves. So my mind indulges in the habit of judging and criticizing other people. Anybody else have that habit? I'm very appreciative of living at the Abbey, where we have space to watch our minds more carefully. One day, when my critical, judgmental mind was just winding up and preparing to go to work, I stopped and listened to the sounds around me. I heard two people in the kitchen making lunch. I could hear another person on the phone speaking with the contractor who was building the new monastic residence. I could see someone fixing the fence. And I thought, They're all offering service to others, and I personally will benefit from their efforts. And the judgmental, complaining mind ground to a halt. This is a reminder that with the guards of mindfulness and introspective awareness, I'm getting better at turning off that yapping, critical voice, and I'm able to actually recognize how kind the people around me are. This completely changes the inner space of my experience and makes living anywhere joyful. I appreciate this environment in which there is space so that the guards of mindfulness and introspective awareness can function. Before I came to the Abbey, I thought I had some level of mindfulness, but now I realize it was nearly zero. Developing these helpful mental factors is like flexing muscles. It takes practice. While we may not have the most conducive environment at our fingertips, wherever we are becomes the field in which we cultivate mindfulness and introspective awareness so that we can destroy the disturbing emotions and accomplish others' good. And that was the experience of another person. So, we have a few minutes for questions, comments. Please ask what's on your mind. This is your chance. Don't be afraid of what other people are going to think about you, because they're too busy thinking about themselves to think about you.
I'm not sure how to word this. The gentleman who brought this up and asked a question before.
Could you speak a little louder?
Yeah, I'm not sure how to word this. And it's the gentleman who spoke before about taking action. Mm-hmm. And I guess I get confused about if trying to learn to accept others as wanting happiness, who perhaps in the news you see are doing harmful things, where there's a line between complacency and if I don't take, I want to keep my emotions peaceful, but is that enough? And how to make change without judging? And obviously some of the actions happening are detrimental, and I feel it's my responsibility not to know that I'm right, but to pass on information to my children and about what they can do to better. I'm just wondering about, you know, how much focus I should put on staying within myself to accept these people as people and human beings, as you said, and how without anger and attachment to be active in making some change.
Okay.
I don't know if I'm wording this.
Yeah, yeah. Let me reword it and tell me if I got it. Okay, so you're wondering how much to put your energy into being peaceful yourself and how much to be active in trying to bring about change outside, and how much to be, and also within that, how to teach your children good values without just getting apathetic and ignoring things. Is that?
Yes. That is.
Is that? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. So I think we need to do both things, you know, in terms of peaceful and being active. But the first thing to do is to become peaceful. Mm? Usually when something happens, we think, what do I do? What do I do? But that's the wrong question. Yeah, the question should be, how can I make my mind peaceful? How can I see the situation more clearly and with some compassion and empathy? That's the question we should ask. And then we should apply, you know, the Buddha taught many methods here to apply to overcome whatever disturbing emotions are prominent in our mind at that time, and to, you know, lessen the unpeacefulness in our mind, to rebalance our mind so that, you know, Because like I said before, when our mind isn't peaceful, we can't communicate in a reasonable way with others. So the first step has to be make our mind peaceful. Then look at the situation. Yeah. And we can still see, oh, there's some behaviors here that are damaging to other people. Yeah. And so I want to help change those behaviors or change the policies or change the systemic attitudes that are behind those behaviors. Yeah. I realize that doing so is going to take some time. Yeah. That I can't, I'm one person, I can't instantly change the entire world. So let's get that dream out of my mind and not expect that. Yeah. But I do want to contribute to a process of healing and of resolving the conflict. Yeah. And so who do I need to talk to in order to do that? So sometimes if it's a personal conflict, the person we need to talk to is the person we're in conflict with. In other words, not go and talk to all of our friends who will agree with us and tell us that we're right and they're wrong and we should hate that person. Because that is not going to help us solve the conflict. You know, we may need to go to our friends and say, my mind's unpeaceful, help me have a peaceful mind. And then after our mind is peaceful, okay, there's a personal conflict, who do I need to talk to? This person, you go to that person and you discuss it with them. Yeah. And here in discussing with them, using Marshall Rosenberg's nonviolent communication is very, very good. It's a good technique to use. And it's not just a technique, it's a way of looking at people, which is what makes it valuable. Techniques alone, you have to have a shift in our mind. Yeah. In terms of teaching your kids, yeah, you know, as a parent, you have responsibility to teach your kids, to teach them good values, to teach them compassion and tolerance and wisdom. Yeah. To teach them that, yes, there's different opinions, but that doesn't mean that we have to hate somebody who has a different opinion. Yeah. And there's lots of examples of people who had different opinions who are now friends. Yeah, and this happens on the political scene. I mean, we fought a war with Germany and Japan, you know, what, 50, 60, 70 years ago? And now they're our best allies. You know, and if we look, this happens all the time. People who don't get along, then in a different situation, they get along. Yeah, so you want to teach your kids and you want to reinforce in your own mind this thing that, you know, not to put people in boxes and think that they have some kind of fixed personality or that the relationship is fixed. Okay? In other situations, you know, maybe rather than go and talk to the person, maybe, you know, because in a, you may have to organize and get together with others who have similar ideas and then bring it to the institution that is involved. Yeah? Or, you know, do some other kind of action that is going to spread the awareness that this is a problem. You know, and I think public protest is one of those methods that could be used. But it's really essential, I think, if you want to communicate that your protest is nonviolent and not accusatory. Because if it becomes, you know, hateful and violent, then our mind has become just like the mind of the people that we're objecting to. Okay? Yeah?
Why wanted to share that our Dharma friend Mary Grace, what she got her students to do, I think in kindergarten or a bit older, was to research the lives of the political candidates right now and to see them that, oh, they've all been children, what their conditioning was like. And she did this as a way to counteract hate speech, you know, that's been going on.
Yeah.
I found that really quite moving.
Yeah. Yeah, because if you see the political candidates as children, your view of them changes a lot, doesn't it? Yeah. And you think, wow, if I grew up in that kind of family, I might have turned out like that person.
Mm-hmm. So dealing with somebody that has alcoholism, do you know you can't change the person because they have that sickness. So can you just, compassion and empathy?
Well, how do you know that you can't change that person, but that person can change?
Yeah.
Can't they?
Yeah, they can.
Yeah. If you say they can't change, then you're just going to enable their alcoholism. You alone cannot change them, but they can change. Yeah. So then you need to see, okay, what conditions are needed to help get this person realize that they have a problem and they can change it. Yeah. And sometimes you telling them, it's going to go way over. You've said it 10,000 times and they can't hear. But sometimes somebody else saying the same things, or sometimes them being in a different situation, or sometime you're not making excuses and letting them experience the result of their alcoholism, can be enough to get that person to go, oh, whoa, you know. I'm creating my own experience here, and I don't like what my experience is, and I need to change. Okay.
So I recently, some time ago, signed up for Facebook. Facebook.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I decided I would just put on things about cute dogs and family trips and that kind of stuff. And I wouldn't participate in any of the political or all these different talks that are going on. And I did that for quite some time. But then I found myself starting to... I was in the middle of my friends that are on the left and my friends that are on the right, and not wanting to offend either friends. And then finally, a couple days ago, I just seen so much hate, and it was just disturbing my inner peace. I just couldn't get over the people that I care and love are posting these hateful things about other people. So I finally just had to put out a post that said, I'm not going to participate anymore, and this is shocking to me seeing all this hate. And for my own inner peace, I just have to stop, take a break for a while. And then, and that I was going to unfriend some people because I couldn't keep seeing these angry posts. So I did that, and it was funny. I got so many responses from people that were like, oh, I so agree with you. And some of them were people that were posting the hate.
I bet.
I learned from reading the anger book that everybody does just want to be happy. So a lot of times I tell myself they just want to be happy, just like me, mm-hmm. you know. But so now I've been hitting the unfriend button. And, my inner peace is coming back because I'm not seeing all this stuff mm-hmm. all the time. And I did put out there that, you know, it was really disturbing to me. But now I'm kind of thinking, okay, should I have handled it any differently?
I think what you did is beautiful, because you spoke about how this was influencing you. You did not accuse anybody else of anything. Because if we accuse, you know, you're saying hateful speech and your speech is disturbing my peace, they're not going to hear you. If you just leave it at all this hateful speech is disturbing my peace, it's disturbing my heart, it's I don't want to live with an attitude of hate and judgment and violence towards others. I want to live with another kind of attitude. And so therefore, I'm don't send me these kind of posts. You saw, you know, that by stating what you felt, then all of a sudden these people came out and agreed with you. Yeah?
That so, wasn't my motivation for doing it.
I know, but look at the good effect it had. You know, you didn't accuse anybody. You simply stated your own feelings, and other people could hear. And it touched them so that they thought, oh, you know, I too want to have a peaceful mind. And maybe all this hate speech that I'm participating in is not contributing to what I really want.
And, you know, I did say in there that I'm sure that some of the things that I post disturb other people too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're not alone. I'm sure I do some things that people find offensive.
Yeah.
Is not in their world belief.
But I think by standing up for peace and harmony, that's a huge statement. And that's going to affect your friends on the right and your friends on the left. Yeah. So I think you handled that quite well, actually.
Well, and then the other effect of doing what you did was that it brought mindfulness to, like, it actually spread mindfulness a little bit. That was what came into my mind. So that ends up being, like, kind of really beneficial in a lot of different ways.
Yeah. Got other people to kind of look at themselves in their speech.
Mm-hmm. I sometimes like find myself, I don't know if burnout is the right word, but wanting to just like disengage or, but I also feel like I'm risking being empathetic, but I feel like that it's so polarized and so charged that I just kind of feel like disillusioned and throw my hands in the air. But then I also wonder like, well, but is, you know, like, kind of like what Gandhi said, you know, be the change you want to see in the world and that sort of thing. But then I think about how politically aware we are now. Everybody seems to be, like, I just feel like, I wonder how, like, political the Buddha was and, like, how important is that really? Like, you know what I mean? Like how, there is that line of, like, should I be involved or should I just focus on my own practice? I mean, I do have opinions about
things. There's different ways. Yeah. Of being involved in different ways of focusing on your own practice. Yeah? So being involved doesn't necessarily mean you have to be out on the street or you have to be writing letters to everybody or spreading your view on Facebook or whatever, taking sides in the whole conflict. Yeah? But, you know, there's many ways to be active. I mean, just saying, look, I don't think that the way this discussion is happening is helpful. That is taking good action. Yeah. And I mean, what I try and do, yes, I have certain ideas about certain things. Yeah. And I would like to see certain things happen in the government. And I comment on it. But I always say, you know, within this, that we have to learn to live together and be peaceful and to discuss together. So, you know, you have to work with your own mind, and then you have to see, okay, what talents and abilities do I have in order to contribute something positive to the discussion? Yeah? And something positive doesn't need to be this side or that side. It can be, let's try and speak to each other and be patient and have harmony, because that's what we all want. That can be a contribution. And, you know, some people want to work on a big level, you know, and some people want to work on a local level with the people that they're involved in. So some people are good at tutoring little kids. You go and tutor little kids. Other people want to go protest in the street. They're good at that. Do that. You know, somebody else wants to, you know, I don't know, contribute in another way. Let them do that. They want to run for office. Let them run for office. Okay? So people have different ways of contributing. But whatever we contribute should be done with the attitude of, you know, we're all in this together. Yeah? instead of me versus you and us versus them.
Try to find some common ground.
Yeah.
Doesn't there come a point in time where maybe you need to step away completely from a situation just so you can get yourself grounded?
Yep.
So I may not be doing anything today, but I may be preparing myself
yep.
for future
yep.
action.
Yep. For sure. For sure. Yeah. That there's nothing wrong with that. Because that's the whole idea, you know, by getting ourselves together, we're doing it for the motivation of being of lasting benefit to others. So it's not a selfish thing to get ourselves together. In fact, it's much more loving than being an untogether person out there creating more trouble. Okay. Okay, this will be the last question.
I feel like we make positive contributions just by working with our own anger and attachment in the way that we then have different, more beneficial personal interactions with people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it's kind of a grassroots level thing.
Yeah.
How we deal with other people.
Mm-hmm. Totally grassroots, you know. And it's very interesting, you know, for me living here, yeah, because I tend to be more on the liberal or progressive side of things, and this part of the state happens to be on more the conservative part of things. But, you know, we deal with people who have different views in this community, yeah. And I remember when we first moved here, the guy who came to help with the septic system was a total libertarian and was telling me how he took out his gun and told the sheriff he needed to get off his property. And I'm like, you know, inside I'm like, But then I found that we could talk about, you know, his son in school and how involved he is in his child's education. And we could talk, you know, in the same way and agree on the school system. Yeah? Even though we had different, you know, views on something else. And so just that, it lets you know, oh, this is a human being. Yeah? It's a complex human being. It's not, you know, a stereotypical cardboard person. So just before we close this session, I want to let you know that the day before, this book arrived, Good Karma, which is a book on another thought training book. This one, Don't Believe Everything You Think, is, you know, the 37 practices of Bodhisattvas, was one thought training poem. This is a commentary on another thought training poem called The Wheel of Sharp Weapons. Yeah, and so it's interesting because it uses the term weapon, yeah, to mean wisdom and compassion, which destroys the enemy of our ignorance and our self-centeredness. Yeah, so it's a different kind of way of using, you know, the imagery of weaponry. Anyway, it just came out in print. So this is the only copy we have here now. It'll be in the bookstores on August 9th. We'll put this, where will we put it where people can take a look?
We can put it on your teaching table where it was, or do you want it?
Well, except didn't we move it for lunch? Oh, the table's still there? Okay, so we'll put it on the table in front of the altar. At lunchtime, you can take a look at it. You can get it directly from Shambhala now, but it'll be at bookshelves.
We should have going to ship on the 6th. So we'll have.
Okay. They're shipping on the. Or they shipped?
I can't remember if she said the 6th to the 8th, but they're going to ship at the end of this week.
Okay. So we'll have them soon.
Are you the author of this book?
They say, I talked with one friend, my very first book, and he was saying that writing a book is like having a baby. Yeah, I haven't had a baby, but but I think sometimes writing a book is more difficult because babies, you know, after 9 months, it's going to be over, except for the next 40 years when they live with me. Yeah, but writing a book, it goes on and on. One revision and another one and the proofs and the this and the that. So when it finally comes out, you're like, I'm so happy that it's over. When you start it, it's, oh, I'm so happy that I get to write it, you know, because it's something you really like and involve in. And then at the end, it's, I'm so glad it's out. Yeah, I don't have to look at another set of proofs and correct the spelling on another set of manuscripts, even though it was the same spelling error I corrected on the previous proofs. Da, 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 da. So I'm all set for everybody to read this and tell me all the typos. Yeah. Okay, so we'll dedicate now. Page
30 in the blue book, folks, the same dedication we did this morning after the meditation.
Due to this merit, may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forever.